Welcome to Hot Plate, a post-foodie podcast. I'm your host, Joshna Maharaj. Today on Hot Plate, awards on pause, rethinking healthy food, airline food at sea level, and when it snows chocolate. Joining us today is Susan Boyle. Susan is a drinks consultant, researcher, writer, storyteller, and performer based in Ireland. She writes about beer, presents drinks features on Irish national television and radio, and hosts tasting and masterclasses. Susan is also one half of Two Sisters Brewing, makers of Bridget's Ale. She is pursuing a PhD at the Technological University of Dublin, focusing on the importance of storytelling and place to beverages, and won an Outstanding Speaker Award at the Oxford Symposium on Food and Cookery for her research. Susan was recently named a Fulbright Creative Ireland Fellow at the Smithsonian Museum of American History. Hello, Susan!
Hey, Joshna, how are you?
I'm so well, my dear. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. I'm great.
Wonderful. Thanks for joining us. You are currently on a lovely green island on the other side of the ocean from me here in Toronto.
I certainly am. Small, wet, green island. We're in Ireland. We've had the wettest August on record for like many years. So we're hoping we'll have a slightly drier this month, but we'll see how it goes. We're used to things raining here, but that's why we're green and things grow.
That's the cost of that lusciousness. Wonderful. I got a few things I want to talk about today. And one, because we are in the same industry, you with mm-hmm. beer and drink and me with food, there is this issue that has come up around the James Beard Awards.
Ah, yes.
Right? We all know mm-hmm. them. They are, I think, casually referred to as the Oscars of,
our industry.
Indeed, in terms of high achievement. And they're put out by the James Beard Foundation, mm-hmm. An American-based foundation. James Beard was a gourmand, let's say. Mm-hmm. And so they're primarily restaurant awards, right?
Yes.
But there are also media awards, mm-hmm. Books, website, blogs, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But what has really risen right now is the idea that they have decided to suspend or cancel the awards for this year.
Yeah, I heard that, Josh. Now, I think it's a really interesting reason why, because we presume in these kind of reasons that it's just because we're living through these unprecedented circumstances in a pandemic, but there's more behind this than just the virus.
Well, it is so fascinating, right? And in fact, it doesn't even seem as though out of all the other issues they're dealing with, the virus is sort of the least of their worries, right?
Yeah.
So the numbers are, there are hundreds of nominees for these mm-hmm. restaurant awards, right? And it's some like 53 or 75, something like that, actual awards that they gave out. And when, after the nomination process, and then there's like a 200 person jury, right? Yeah. That makes the choices. This year, what netted out at the end was that while there were a handful, I think, of Black chefs nominated for the awards, mm-hmm. there ended up being zero Black chefs winning any of the awards.
The thing is that it's just not representative of the industry. Like, you want an industry that is representative and feels like you can have people involved in it so that you're representing different cultures, different backgrounds, different experiences. Right. And if you have an award system that the people who tend to win awards are of one specific background, then it doesn't represent, and it doesn't leave space either, Josh. Now, this is more the thing. Like, they shouldn't be, like, I think sometimes there's these conversations that I've gotten into about just how important it is to take affirmative action on representation.
Right.
And you don't want someone getting something just because they tick a box, but you want space so that someone brilliant can be acknowledged.
And that's a nice way to put it.
That needs
to
be encouraged.
Yep. It's to me, when I first heard that, I thought, how fascinating that it's not just about being nominated, right? It's about figuring out what the distance might be mm-hmm. between the way Black chefs exhibit excellence and what James Beard is looking for.
Well, that's so true, right? As well. It's like, where are the standards? Like, there's some very interesting stuff that's happening in a different industry, because you referenced the Oscars at the moment, and they've come out with some really interesting guidelines about how they want to see a more diverse industry. And that's going to trickle right down to the, I think the Oscars they're aiming for this for is 2024. But they're hoping that by that stage, there'll be like representation across everything, like even the backstage stuff, the people who are involved in the set, involved in costuming, that it's not like you need, if you want representation, you want these, if you want to tell the stories of people, if you want to eat the food of people, you need to see those people in kitchens, in front of house, writing about it as well. It has to be inclusivity doesn't just stop at one level. It has to be throughout the whole system as well. And that's really important, I think. Like everyone eats food, Josh. Like it's ridiculous that we even have to think about this. Like everyone eats, like simple as that.
The one thing that really struck me about this is the fact that we still seem to have to work really hard to put this together, right? That to me also is a nod to how we understand who a chef is.
Yeah, that is so
true. And as somebody who's never really been that caricature, you know what I mean? That sort of cutout or that stereotype, it is, I get this, you know, I understand this because my cooking and the way I approach the kitchen has been always outside the lines of the canon, which is what James Beard really espouses.
But they talk a little bit about that too, even just in the differences of how we cook, like the differences between being home cooks and nurturing and just actually eating at home versus those kind of experiences that get exalted in kind of restaurant culture of like going out for a meal, you know, and there's an awful lot to... There's an awful lot to kind of unpick in relation to that, in relation to privilege and position. And even something as simple as like being able to set up a business and have like the ownership. Like I always think back to how like my background is, as you know, in lots of beer and brewing and that kind of side of things. And historically, it was women who were brewers because women... didn't have premises of their own necessarily, you know? So this is something that they could do in their own home. They could make beer and they could make bread and they could sell this, and that's how they could create and sustain an income for themselves independently of anyone else, you know? And it was only when things became more industrialized and breweries became things that happened in specifically purpose buildings that women became not part of the brewing story for a long period of time. And I think that when you think of restaurants as well and how we look at these award ceremonies and who we put up there as the pinnacles of an industry, you have to think about like access. It's just easier for some people of particular economic means or particular backgrounds to be able to gain access to that, and it excludes a lot of people. So I think it's right that these awards are taking a step back and going, how do they make sure that they're not playing a part in continuing that story? How do they shift the narrative?
That's right. I also appreciate it. Because in addition to this issue around race and unequal sort of representation around race, they also have a shower, it seems, of reports and stories of inappropriate behavior, use of power, and sexual harassment from horrible. Many of both nominees and would-be winners.
Yeah.
Right. And that, like, simultaneously, this is a serious 1-2, right? No, no mention of virus yet at this point, right? Or killing me, or the economic devastation of the industry. Yeah. No mention of that
yet. No mention of that. That small thing that just happened. Do you think that what happens is that there's an opportunity when we've had this enormous paradigm shift that we're living in now to really start rethinking where do our values lie? Yes. And I think I would, you know, maybe it's the little Pollyanna optimistic person in me, but I would really hope that this huge shift that has happened in the last few months will give us an opportunity to take a step back and to really think about where does our value system lie? What are the traits that we want to encourage and include? And hopefully with something like this, with the awards, taking that step back and going, hang on a second, if somebody wins an award, but they're an absolutely horrible person, if I go to their restaurant, for example, and I patronize them and I spend my money in that environment, I'm part of that problem then too, Josh, and I don't want to be. Like, that's ridiculous. That's like me sitting there eating something delicious for my own pleasure and not thinking of all the lives of the people that have been affected around that. And I don't want to play a part in that.
Yep.
You know?
I am with you. And delightfully, our friends at James Beard Foundation agree. Yay. Right. And I was really pretty impressed to see that the way they described this break was to for them to take a moment to reconsider what excellent behavior or skills look like from chefs, right?
That is so hopeful, isn't it?
I think so too.
It's really, and also that they're taking the real time to do this. This isn't just a, hey, we're not having an award ceremony this year because, you know, the global situation. It's like, hang on a second, guys. We're going to actually really step back from this. We're going to really work out where our values lie. We're going to really look at what excellence means in our industry at a time when excellence is more important than ever for the industry's survival.
Right.
And they're going to come back and celebrate that. I'm very excited about that, Joshna.
Now, I will say, though, while that is incredibly promising, exciting news. I had higher hopes for what my, you know, this was my year. I was very excited about my book being nominated and in the runnings. So I hope that they have some sort of creative catch-all 2 years in our, you know what I mean?
In their consideration. Because it's, you know what, this is a really interesting thing. It's these kind of, there's the bigger picture, but then there's the really personal disappointments that we've all had to deal with in the last few months. And I think, yeah, you need to be celebrated too. And the work that you've done should have the opportunity to reach different audiences too. So hopefully there will be some way around that.
And that I look forward to it. And I was hoping so. I was like, oh no, James Beard, this was supposed to be my year.
No, that's terrible.
But anyhow, this is a much better idea, and I wish, like, honestly,
how selfless well of you. Isn't that
navigating
just, I think I'd still be just going, I'm meant to be a winner.
No, I was like, this was my, I'm gonna, right? Anyhow, it's very interesting move. I cannot wait to hear what they come up with, because it really could be a beautiful way that we start to push this change throughout the entire industry if we really redefine who chefs are and what excellent behavior, you know, or excellent sort of traits are among those chefs. That could be very, very exciting. Susan, there's something you'd like to talk about. What are you thinking about?
Yeah, Joshna. So I've been having these ideas mulling around in my head for quite a while about the idea of like what healthy food is and how I really think that we need a little bit of a rethink on that. Part of it is fueled by a couple of things. My kind of hatred, but inability to look away from Instagram is definitely one of those. And I find that on that platform, which I'm learning to come to terms with, that there's just so much stuff that's about like what is healthy and how what we eat or what we choose to eat equates to a level of healthiness. And then also there's a level of blame that's pushed back on people as well who aren't aspiring to this notion of healthiness. And I just hate that. I want to strip that out because I feel that there's been, especially around female bodies, there's been so much guilt that's associated with how people look and how food plays into that and factors into that. I just prefer if they were separated. And from a very personal level, my mom died in the new year this year, completely suddenly and completely out of the blue.
That was a heartbreaking thing. I remember that moment.
It still is, Joshua.
Indeed.
It still is a very difficult thing to live with. But it also, like, it was playing on my mind too, because I have this inkling feeling that she maybe could have got better health care earlier if people had seen some of the symptoms of her heart condition a little earlier. But she was a woman who she had a double knee transplant last year, so she wasn't as active as she normally was, and she put on a bit of weight, you know? And I believe that that there are aspects of her diet that were seen as being causal to the condition that she was in. And I don't know if they were or not, but I'd like to separate that out, really. And I'd like people to get healthcare based on their condition and on what they're showing, rather than being told, well, you know what, if you lose a few pounds, everything will be okay.
Oh man.
Because I just don't think it's healthy. And what we think is healthy, I see so many people on social media platforms who are clearly not eating full diets, like not getting the nutrition that they obviously would need for all the healthy aspects of you. And I question this when we confuse health and healthy, where that kind of lies. And it's a frustration for me.
I am with you 100%. I come across it a lot in the work that I do because it's public sector institutions, grassroots community work. The conversation around it's not just food that we need to get to people. Yeah. We need healthy food. And then there's like, well, who's deciding what that is?
Exactly.
Right? Who makes those calls about what healthy food is? And one of the things that I've come across with so much frustration is that there it is one specific perspective. Yeah. Right? Michael Pollan calls it nutritionism.
Yes.
Right? Which I think is completely accurate. However you understand that, the thing that I think is perhaps most impactful for people is this notion of somebody in a white coat wagging their finger at you. Right? Yeah. And that implicit, like, but no question, health and healthy eating is something that we have to sacrifice for.
Yeah, and it goes against everything in my being, Josh. Now, food is so much more as well than just its nutritional component. It's about family. It's about communities. It's about things that grow in the ground. And it's also, do you know what? There's an awful lot of privilege that's involved in it. The idea that you can choose what to eat and then condemn other people for the choices that maybe they can't make.
Yeah.
Like, you know, even just the skills of being able to cook, like physically, not even like actually the technique. I'm talking about having the pots, having a kitchen.
Sure,
having
and
a
being
space,
able to stand at a stove and do a thing, yes.
And having the time to do that. Like, there's so much more that needs to be kind of unpicked in this. And I just really feel, I feel strongly that that when it comes down to then a health thing, that I just want to deeply wish that there's some way of getting over this kind of notion of what is healthy from one perspective and realizing a more holistic aspect to it, you know?
Definitely. There's one of the things when you were speaking that I was really thinking about was the irony about the fact that but particularly for people who live in big bodies, right? Bigger, larger bodies, that is always the thing that a doctor says, right? It's a bit of a running joke. I have this experience in my life where you might go into the doctor's office for like a skin condition. You know what I mean? Or like a little itchy eye or something. And their solution will invariably be to lose a few pounds.
Yeah.
And then it'll sort itself out. Like that is a chronically reliable thing. But what really strikes me here is that at this point, like at the point after your mom had two knees replaced, you know, and sort of around her, you know, her very sudden death, that conversation connecting her diet to health, you know, to her mortality that way.
Oh, I literally had a conversation with her doctor after she died and I was in absolute shock. And I was like, how did this happen? And the doctor said, your mom was overweight. She couldn't live forever. And I was like, I know she couldn't live forever, but I didn't expect her to like be reasonably okay and then not. Like, Josh, she seemed fine. Like, her conditions was her legs were swollen, she was short of breath, and she was a bit tired. And like, it was the week after Christmas, you know?
Right.
Who isn't?
It's a very solid January position, right?
Was like, I felt like that for most of January. I don't think she was feeling any particularly worse, but these are signs of like of heart trouble, and it wasn't picked up. And she, like, her father had heart trouble too as well, so this and he died suddenly when he was in his
on.
These are completely clear pointers, and then for someone to say, oh, it's because your mom was overweight, I just don't trust that. I think that there are more, like, yes, I know that the weight thing is something that can be addressed, but I don't know if it's chicken and egg. I don't know where it sits. I'm not a medical doctor either.
Yeah.
I obviously have to acknowledge that. But it's, you know, when people are being denied healthcare because there's a very obvious thing that you can focus on, and instead of looking at what can be ameliorated to actually make a difference to the quality of life, and rather than the long term, oh, just you lose a few pounds and everything will be okay.
Right.
I think there's other things that need to be addressed too. And on that note, though, what's really cool is that there has been new guidelines that have been passed in Canada.
Okay.
And one of them is really wonderful. It says that they're, and this is coming from the Canadian Medical Association Journal had published this piece on it. And what they said is that they are looking for a guideline that you have to, that a physician has to ask permission before they discuss their patient's weight with them. And I was like, oh, that would be just really lovely. Because then we could get like, you know, the important things. And then if they want to do an add-on about like, oh, I should lose a bit of weight, then they can actually give some maybe constructive help around that for that person.
Well, and I like it even just from a mindfulness perspective.
Yeah.
Right? For we just have to pause for a minute before everybody leaps in the direction of vilifying fat and fatness. Right?
Yeah.
Like can we slow this down?
There's so many things I've even thought about it with the whole with the way we've had to like socially distance more. And I remember my first encounter of going to the supermarket a couple of months ago and realizing how people negotiate space differently and really noticing that there's a lot of gender differences in how people negotiate space. Like women in general, and this completely generalization is from personal observation, tended to be more aware of how much space they physically took up.
Yes.
And I think this happens. This happens in bodies that have become public in those kind of mm-hmm. ways because mm-hmm. of the size and the space that they take up, that there's this kind of the owning of space, that there's so many people who never have to consider the space that they take up in the world.
Definitely.
You know, and I don't think, I think women are particularly aware of the space that they take up. And I think larger bodies are even more aware of the space that they take up in the world. And it, you know, it's just an interesting consideration. And I'm glad that, yeah, that if it's just not the first thing at people's minds, that then maybe someone will get the help that my mom didn't. And that would be
amazing.
Well,
this is it, right? And to your point earlier about it needing to be more holistic, how mm-hmm. we just understand the role that food plays, the varying reasons why some bodies are bigger than other bodies, right? We just tend to be really easy with the notion that it's all because people are gorging on sweets in a closet somewhere, right? Like that is just sort of how we understand this. So Susan, something that has been really interesting to me is to observe the kind of ripples of curious things that are happening as a result of this wild pandemic that we're living in, right? There are so many offshoot things that we had, mm-hmm. like for a crazy off example is we here in Toronto, mm-hmm. Don't like clothing donation boxes and places where you would go to, you know, leave old clothes and after you've done a spring clean, they were overrun.
Because
everybody was at
too.
Home, right? Everybody was at home and cleaning and sorting it all
out.
The boxes were spilling over because we couldn't manage it, right? And I thought that was so interesting to think about stuff like that. So in that same spirit, I recently heard about airlines, right? Because mm-hmm. obviously nobody is, taking a flight anywhere. But there are catering companies who produce those meals that are served on airlines, right? Gate Gourmet is the name of one of them. Mm-hmm. And they have been literally sitting on a stockpile of meals. Right?
And they're all frozen too, Josh.
And they're all exactly, right? They are all portioned and frozen with all of the right labeling and all of the things that you might need. And so what Gate Gourmet has started doing and many other airlines have followed is to start just selling off these meals mm-hmm. incredibly cheaply.
Yeah.
Right. And that to me is fascinating because I read about this and I read about people's responses to mm-hmm. this. And the thing that I thought was so great was that people were able to recalibrate their expectations, right? Very quickly. All of a sudden, when you're getting this meal at a deal for $2, it seemed to be much more enjoyable than the frustration of, when you're actually
really
on the plane,
ticket, yeah.
right? When you're like, I paid this much for the ticket and this
and
is
this
the lousy
is what I'm
meal.
Gonna eat. Yeah, because I've always, like, I have to admit that I have a soft spot for those meals. I like the way they're laid out. And
I've
just, and maybe it's because when I started flying, things were a little bit more, there was a little bit more glamour, there's a little bit more effort.
Ryanair
wasn't
yes.
on the scene, you know? So we weren't hopping all over Europe, but when we went, it was like a bit of a bigger thing. And so I suppose maybe there's that nostalgia involved in it. I love this idea of seeing what it's like at home. I imagine though that they have to calibrate some of the flavors and that it tastes a little differently, because I know that when you're at altitude, you don't taste the same way as you do you're down on the ground. So I believe that they make things a little saltier. And I know that particularly there was some great things where I know that a BA, British Airways, used to test all their wines at altitude as well.
Certain
aromatics that carried through better. Apparently champagne is the thing to go for because the bubbles help with like a better experience.
That's right. I read that too. And to realize in many cases, I think I heard that people that the preference was for perhaps a cheaper wine or a lower quality wine because of the way it performed 40,000 feet in the air.
And because it's a little bit more what you taste these things straight off. They don't need to have that subtlety or that nuance that that you can mull over and enjoy when you're down on terra firma. In the air, you're looking for things that like taste like wine and are very kind of recognizable as well. I think it's just such a fun idea. But also, I suppose on a very practical level, like the food waste that would potentially come from these stockpiles of meals.
Yes.
And if there's any opportunities that they can go to people and help them out so that you can have a freezer full of things that you can throw in that's already pre-portioned, that's done. There's and also I can just imagine what it's like to pick them up and what are you getting? Like what happens if you just got all the breakfast stuff?
Yeah. All the omelets, all the weird breakfast burritos and omelets. I know. I thought it was so fascinating. Like I quite enjoy an airplane meal. Mm-hmm. And all right, it's not great food.
No.
But I have time, right? But it fascinated me to see because they also, I think that there was some talk of the airlines also selling their wine supplies, right? They were selling
lots
bottles.
Of tiny little bottles.
Yeah, and they were selling those little guys, the little shop bottles for like $2.99 or something like that a piece, which is really, really interesting.
Well, I know that there's a brewery here in Ireland, which is one of the first breweries to bring in canning lines for like the smaller sized beer cans. And they were able to get an exclusive on Aer Lingus and on a couple of other airlines. And it was that was what their business was based on. It was like supplying to airlines. And it was simply because they had the right packaging for it. So a lot of this, you know, selling to a certain place is to do with how, especially an airline, is to do with just the size of what you have. Like, you know, can you package, you know, your little snacks in those tiny little packets, you know? And I also had a fascinating conversation randomly in a bar in Madrid with a girl that I literally just bumped into in a bar. And she was saying that her main job was she was working in the alcohol industry, but supplying to airlines. And she came up with the idea of putting like packets of alcohol, so it's like the pre-portioned flat pack alcohol that she came up with that idea, which is really clever. And she was like, it's kind of one of these like, how did you make all your money? And she's like, well, let me tell you about what I did. And she sold it all throughout Africa. I think she was based in Botswana. And she was able to sell into like South Africa and a number of other places on the continent. And that was her claim to fame. She came up with that idea. And I was like, that's like really clever. So sometimes like solving a packaging question can really kind of improve things. And I've noticed that as well with them. With craft beer sales in Ireland, it's been notoriously difficult to get your beer on taps behind Irish bars because those taps tend to be owned by larger beer companies
and
don't want to give up the space, right?
Yep, I know this.
But
yes,
when we went into pandemic, people started ordering things to their houses. So any of the smaller craft breweries or the craft breweries that were producing beer in cans, it meant that all of a sudden they had access to so many more people because they could send out cans in the post that weren't going to break. There was no glass, there's no issue with that.
Smart.
You know, and it was I talked to a number of brewers who said that it was a real lifeline for the breweries, that they were selling way more stuff direct to people. And it was simply because, you know, maybe last year, the year before, a couple of years before, they'd made the decision to move away from bottles and move into cans, and cans are lighter and they're easier to ship and they don't break, so more
not knowing that
beer.
Soon enough they were gonna have to start shipping their beer all over
beer,
the place.
Yeah, it's like these things that you just don't know are going to actually be quite savvy moves that end up having this kind of repercussion.
I love it. It's like when this is very much when one door closes and another few windows open.
Yeah, the window
it's
opens.
It's really, really sweet.
I would love to try those airplane foods. I just want to know what they're eating in first class, Josh, now, you know?
Oh, good call. I love that.
What's the swankiest airplane meal I can get? That's what I want to try.
Okay, Susan. So I heard this really lovely thing that I want to talk about. At this moment in time, I find myself really excited about delightful stories.
Yes, I think we need a bit of delight, Josh.
Right, exactly. So apparently, sometime in August, I believe, there was a ventilation backup in the Lindt factory, in the Lindt chocolate factory in Switzerland, right? And it's where I believe they were grinding cacao nibs.
Oh, wow. Right.
So what ended up happening with this backup on the ventilation was that the exhaust pushed out ground cacao nibs into the atmosphere, right? Throughout because there were also high winds, right? Yep. It was this cocktail of backed up exhaust plus high Swiss winds that culminated in this amazing snow of chocolate in this, in the town, in the area around the factory.
Wow. Right. That's like all my childhood dreams come true, isn't it? It's a little Charlie in the Chocolate Factory.
I can't even, I'm sure that there are many people were around who were like, this was a real problem. That dog, I'm sure.
Yeah,
if
you were washing out in the line, you'd just done a whitewash and you were hanging it up, that's going to be a problem. But my goodness,
what a thing. Just to stand tongue out, ready to catch a little bit of that from what a lovely thing. What I felt was so sweet was that in classic Swiss way, where they have, their wonderful neutrality, they were just like, they were very matter of fact about this is what happened, backup. Yes. We apologize for any inconvenience, but I was like, what a dream. I hope some people went running, like a dervish in the streets to appreciate all of that.
It's just a cute idea. And I think at these, just the idea that something like that can happen. And also, I'm really glad it was a chocolate factory. I'm sure there's other things that these ventilation things happen and it's horrible things happen.
Right. And we've heard there was a story about the factory where they make sriracha.
Oh, right?
And there was this issue about the screens the filters that they needed to put on the exhaust, and there was a battle about whether they were going to do it, and that would expunge all this capsaicin, the capsicum, into the air, and people's eyes were burning.
Wild
and insane. So when things go wrong at a nearby factory, it can be very exciting.
Things go really wrong.
Yes, congratulations, Lynn. I think that's such a lovely story. If you're enjoying our podcast, you can support us at patreon.com/hotplatepod. Hot Plate is part of the Frequency Podcast Network. Please consider leaving us a rating or review. It helps others find us. You can follow me at Joshna Maharaj on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can follow our guest, Susan Boyle, at Miss_Susan Boyle on Twitter and at Susan Boyle Instagram on Instagram. Hot Plate is produced by Mirella Amato and Dennis Coyne, with original music by Dave Bell. Thanks for listening.